Well, the big reason I'm here this evening is to talk about the 3 weeks that I was gone, what I observed, what I saw, to give a bit of a background about especially this conference in Budapest, and especially the story of how this conference was suppressed by the Hungarian government. A few weeks ago, the crackdown by the authorities in Hungary of this conference, which was called the Future of Europe Conference in Budapest, made headlines around the world. This was to be a conference in the Hungarian capital of nationalists, traditionalists, and what they call identitarians. For those who don't know about this, it's a kind of new movement in Europe, and several of the speakers are going to represent this so-called identitarian movement. Speakers from across Europe as well as from the United States. And in fact, oddly enough, even though it's a Future of Europe conference, the main organizers of the conference were not Europeans, or at least not strictly Europeans, they were Americans. Above all, it was an organization called the National Policy Institute, and it was the initiative, above all, of the youthful and energetic director of this organization, the NPI, Richard Spencer. Now, some of you may be familiar with this. They have a website, and they do different things. News of the crackdown, which included a police raid on a private gathering in Budapest by Hungarian police, who detained and then expelled Spencer, as well as a defiant, upbeat replacement meeting, received detailed coverage in the Hungarian media, and it generated important media coverage elsewhere. Now, some of you may have seen the BBC News report with photos that we put on our website and we distributed as well. And if you don't already, that is a pretty fair, pretty accurate summary of what happened, including the meeting that was the replacement meeting that I'll talk about a little bit more. Now, this meeting originally was scheduled to have as speakers not just Richard Spencer, but the most controversial speaker originally scheduled was a Russian named Alexander Dugin, a writer and theoretician whose ideas and theories I'm not able to really understand very well. If you've seen him speak, in fact, on the web, you can see the talk that he was going to give at this event. And to me, it's very, very cloudy and so forth. But he was one of the most main speakers. And he was cited by the Hungarian authorities as a reason to suppress the meeting because he's a Russian. And supposedly, the Hungarians said Hungary suffered under the Russians. I think it's all a pretext, as I'll say further on when I get more into the detail of the whole event. We don't really know the whole story about exactly what considerations were in play by the Hungarian authorities, by the government of the Prime Minister in suppressing this. Among the other speakers, besides Alexander Dugin and Richard Spencer, was also Jared Taylor. Many of you are familiar with him. He's the director of American Renaissance, which calls itself a race realist organization and publishing center. And also, one of the speakers was to be a leading figure of the Jobbik Party. Now, the Jobbik Party has gotten a lot of attention in the international media because of some of the statements made by some of its leaders. It's considered a really dangerous dissident party, and it does reflect a lot of the unhappiness in Hungary with the establishment ruling parties, the Fidesz Party, which is the ruling party, and the Social Democratic Party, or the Socialist Party, which is a successor to the old Communist Party. Another speaker was Tomislav Sunik. Many of you may remember that he's spoken at several IHR meetings, including, as it happens, just a few weeks ago, on the 20th of September, Tom Sunik spoke right here. Another person who was supposed to speak was John Morgan. He's director of something called the Arctos Publishing Center, and he has moved to Budapest, and that was one of the reasons why later there was problems with him. Now, on the forthcoming conference was announced on the website of the NPI, and already weeks before, the Southern Poverty Law Center, which monitors such things, and other organizations had paid attention to this and had already expressed their alarm and unhappiness about this conference. And the Hungarian government first issued a statement denouncing the conference, and then on the 29th of September, just several days before it was supposed to begin, the Hungarian government announced that it was banning this conference. Now, as I said, the whole story about just why and how the government of Prime Minister Viktor Orban decided to ban the conference is not known and perhaps never will be known. But Hungary is not a strong country. Hungary is a country of some 10 million people. It's subject to more pressure, and it already has been subject to pressure, including by other organizations, of the World Jewish Congress, which I think was last year defiantly held its annual international conference in Budapest to emphasize how much they wanted to keep Hungary in line and to show their power there. The World Jewish Congress, which is, of course, a very, very powerful organization, has repeatedly made clear how worried they are about the situation in Hungary. Now, why Hungary is a special problem is there's historical reasons for that, which I'm going to go into. In July, I was just an attendee at the conference. I wasn't a speaker, and I was not registered at the hotel where most of the people were staying who were going to attend the conference. It's one of the reasons why I wasn't flagged or so forth coming into Hungary. Although, frankly, the only people that were actually detained by the Hungarian authorities were two. Richard Spencer, the director whose picture and involvement with the conference was well known, and the chairman of the National Policy Institute, William Regnery. But in July, because I know Spencer, I wrote a message to him, a warning, or at least expressing my concern that efforts would be made to try to ban this conference. And at the time, this was in July, my warnings were dismissed as, oh, you don't know what you're talking about, we've got this all under control, everything's going to be fine. The Jobbik, which is an important political party in Hungary, they say they're going to support this, so don't worry. And in fact, when Tom Sunak was here on the 20th of September, I expressed the same concerns. I said, well, I'm concerned that they're going to try to ban this. Now, the reason I say this, and the reason I am concerned, is because there's a record of these kinds of interferences by outside forces. Some years ago, there was a conference that was planned in Beirut, and the American government ordered the Lebanese government to ban the conference in Lebanon. Edward Snowden documents that have been made public show that the U.S. government tried to interfere in Latvia to stop circulation of a book written by a Latvian attorney about the communist takeover of his country. The American government was particularly concerned because this book highlighted the Jewish role in the communist takeover of Latvia. And, of course, Israel has already made it clear. The foreign minister of Israel, a man named Lieberman, has said publicly that no political party in Europe should cooperate, even collaborate, with the Jobbik party in Hungary. Now, given all of this, and later, as I'm going to point out, the role of the United States Embassy afterwards, I was concerned, given this track record, that this might happen. Well, in fact, as I said, the Hungarian government did ban the conference. In addition to that, the chairman of the NPI, William Regnery, who's a publisher, was prevented from entering Hungary when he arrived by air. But Richard Spencer did get into the country because he came into Hungary by train from Vienna. And there's no border controls between Vienna and Hungary. They're members of what's called the Schengen group of countries. And once you get into any one of them, you can go to any of them without any border controls. So he got into Hungary. And in fact, the evening of Thursday, the 2nd of October, a group of us met together for dinner, including Richard Spencer. But then the next evening, Friday, October 3rd, Spencer was arrested. He and a group of people were at a cafe called the Clock Cafe, or the Big Clock Cafe, and the police came in. There were some 40, well, it depends on your estimates, 40, 20, 30 police all showed up for this event. And for various reasons I'll get into later, I was not at that event, although I heard about this, of course, the next day from many people who were. The police were actually surprised. They first came in and thought they were at the wrong place. The Hungarian media had played up this thing in big articles. Everybody in Hungary seemed to be aware of this conference, and taxi drivers knew about it, people in the street knew about it. In fact, there was even a demonstration about it that I happened to witness on one occasion. And they gave the impression, however, that this conference was beefy, bald, tattoo-wearing, sort of troglodyte skinheads who were going to be at this thing. And the police, when they came into the cafe, were actually thought at first they'd come to the wrong place, because most of them are sort of middle-aged people, scholarly people. They were some young people, fairly well-dressed and so forth. And even more astonishingly, one or two of the policemen actually apologized for arresting and detaining Richard Spencer and other people for having done all of this, because this group was obviously no threat to anybody. Far from inciting any kind of hatred, nobody either was planning or would have said anything that could be construed, except in the most bizarre way, as any kind of incitement or call for hatred. But Spencer was taken away. He also did a foolish thing. He at first was asked for his ID, and he gave a false name. He shouldn't have done that, because in Hungary, and this is an unusual thing, everyone by law in Hungary is required to have ID on him at all times. And he didn't have his passport with him. Well, for that reason alone, they detained him. They kept him for several days. And he was then deported from the country, and he's now forbidden, at least on paper, from entering not only Hungary, but all the other countries of the so-called Schengen zone for 2 or maybe 3 years. That's a pretty severe thing, considering he actually didn't commit any crime and wasn't even planning to, nothing that was really illegal. But Hungary can do that, at least supposedly they can do that under their laws. Now, in addition to the arrest of Spencer, the hotel where most of the attendees were going to be staying canceled all the bookings. And also the nearby place where the conference was to take place also canceled its contract with NPI. And in addition to that, John Morgan, who's the American living in Budapest who runs Arctos, he was supposed to be coordinating this thing. He was so fearful that his residence permit or his ability to stay there would be jeopardized, he washed his hands of the whole thing. And then Jobbik, they washed their hands of the whole thing also and just said, we're having nothing to do with this thing. Now, part of the reason people speculate is that an election was coming up, and Jobbik had there's no advantage for Jobbik of being associated with a group that the Hungarian newspapers were telling everybody is some terrible, hateful group. Well, given this situation then, there's no hotel, the bookings are canceled, the local organizers are out, Jobbik is out. Under these circumstances, and Spencer, the main organizer, he's detained and being thrown out of the country. Under these circumstances, the situation, of course, was very, very grim and discouraging. But one person did take initiative under showing, I think, extraordinary presence of mind, and saved what could be saved out of all of this mess. And even though Jared Taylor was only a scheduled speaker and not an organizer, he took the initiative to find a suitable venue for a private replacement event so that people would have something to go to, at least would be able to meet. And as a result, there was a very pleasant dinner gathering on Saturday evening, October 4th, at a traditional Hungarian restaurant on the Buda or western side of the city. Now, I'm going to go a little bit more into this. Buda and Pest used to be two separate cities. They both are on the Danube River, but they were combined in the 19th century into the city of Budapest. The Buda side is older, it's hilly, there's a castle at the top. It's the more traditional side of the city. The Pest side is flat, and it's where most of the people live, and it's more most of the buildings or so forth are there. Anyway, this restaurant was on the Buda side of the city, and why that's important I'll mention a little bit later. Now, although this conference was certainly not the conference that so many had planned for with all of these speakers, the spirit among the attendees was very positive, very upbeat. There was a big feeling, precisely because the authorities were fighting it and all this thing was going on, of a combative and even a spirit of solidarity and comradeship out of all of this. Now, I talked, of course, to people at the dinner gathering that took place, but the most interesting and most, I think, productive conference discussions I had was not at that event. It was really apart from the event itself, more in London, even in Paris, and also with people outside of that evening. And often as these things go, the most interesting thing are not the speakers themselves or the event themselves, but the kind of interaction and cross-fertilization and networking that takes place outside of the actual conference itself. At this replacement dinner evening, there were really only two speakers, Tom Sunak and Jared Taylor. Tom Sunak's talk, for those who were here on the 20th of September, was the same talk he gave on that occasion. It was basically the same event. And Jared Taylor's, though, talk was a very memorable one. And by the way, it's available, the text of it, and I think even a video of it is available on the web. And Taylor's talk was very well written, very effective, and even very emotional. If you've been to talks by Jared Taylor before, when he starts talking about his ancestors and starts talking about what we're all involved in, he became very emotional, started choking up, but he carried on and he was given a standing ovation at the end of it. And that was something, it's helped set something of the spirit of this event. in addition to that, Taylor was very good with the media, and he is a very practiced person interacting with the media. He's had lots of experience doing that, and I saw a lot of this interaction myself when he spoke to reporters and journalists from a number of different countries, including the BBC, and he's able to answer questions very clearly, very well. He's very poised, and that was, I think, an important part of all of this. The next day, many of the attendees met at what's called Heroes Square in Budapest. It's a very impressive big plaza with a large museum, some neoclassic structure buildings, an enormous monument in the center to Hungarian figures from history. And it's a very impressive place, very, very beautiful, which I'll go into more. So many people met there, and they went and saw different parts of the city. Originally, people from Jobbik were supposedly going to organize some tours, but as I said, they just washed their hands of the entire event, and so they were out of the whole scene. In fact, one of the odd things about this conference that did take place, is even though it took place in Budapest, and even though it was called a Future for Europe conference, there was precisely one Hungarian at the whole event, and he was some young guy who happened to read about it in the newspapers and sort of gotten involved and into it that way, because so unfortunately it didn't really have as much interaction with Hungarians. But that's part of the problem of a lack of planning, which I'll go into in a little bit. After that evening, also many of the attendees sort of took over this restaurant or pub. It was called the Dracula Cafe or the Dracula Restaurant. So it's actually run by a Romanian, I think. For those of you who don't know, there was this Dracula, and he lived in what was Transylvania. It's now claimed by Romania and so forth. But it was a very fun event, and there was probably more interaction going on, greased with lots of alcohol, than there was at the actual dinner itself. Now, some very important things, I think, can be learned from all of this event, lessons to be learned from it. One is that even though the event did not take place the way people expected, it was a daring and, I think, bold thing. And I think that boldness is a virtue even of itself, even if it doesn't work out. I think that's to be applauded. I think people who take initiative, that's always, if it's anything kind of positive, I think that's always good, even if it doesn't work out as well. Because even events that are have a lot of problems, that are mistakes, people learn from that. And I know that Spencer, and I know a lot of people, learn some important things to avoid if there's going to be any conferences like this in the future. Another one is the danger of wishful thinking. Many people who are active in whatever cause it is often are guilty of planning based on not the reality, but upon what they wish to happen. And this was especially true in this case as well. Many people assume that because Hungary's out of the way, it's not in Paris or not in London, they could sort of slip in under the radar. That's wishful thinking. In fact, the World Jewish Congress and Israel and the United States pay close attention to what's going on in Hungary. And the idea they can sort of slip in is absolutely childish, I think. The another thing to learn from this event, I think, is the importance of having reliable, solid local people on the ground. And when I mean reliable, people that aren't going to flake off when the going gets tough, which is what happened in this case. And also, even though the event did not take place the way people expected, I think the media coverage of the event was basically good. There was a very lengthy article in Die Welt about the conference, which was essentially pretty fair, pretty accurate article. And the BBC article was more or less valid, but more or less fair, fairly good article about it. I think part of the credit for that is to Taylor, who handled the media people very well. Media people don't like it if you're trying to BS them, if you're trying to pull one over on them, if you try to fool them. And I think his handling of it. Now, one of the most interesting aspects of this entire conference was the role of the United States government in this. This was highlighted by one journalist who's there, who called up the American Embassy, but the American Embassy in Budapest issued a statement by the way, there's no U.S. ambassador in Hungary. There's a chargé d'affaires. The United States government is not happy with Viktor Orban because he's not very happy being squeezed by the United States and by other Britain and Germany to some extent over the Ukraine situation. And Hungary has made clear that they're more willing to cooperate with Russia than the American government would like. And they have shown their displeasure by issuing statements about this. But the U.S. chargé d'affaires at the U.S. Embassy in Budapest is an American official named André Goodfriend, and he issued a statement approving the Hungarian ban on this conference. Now, this is, to me, outrageous. I mean, imagine if Hungary were to issue statements pontificating on meetings that take place in New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles. They'd say, well, what kind of arrogant interference is that? But the United States government, of course, routinely now around the world pontificates and points fingers and gives judgments about conferences that take place all over the world. Now, my 3 weeks, I was gone altogether 3 weeks in Hungary, in Britain, in England, in France, and in Northern Virginia, in the Washington, D.C. area. And from all of this, I mean, one of my main reasons of going was to also get a better understanding of the situation and of bigger trends that are going on in Europe. Because, as you know, I talk a lot about these kinds of things. I get interviewed about it. And I think overall this was a very valuable and useful thing. I had numerous meetings, talks, conversations, sometimes very extensive ones, with activists, writers, publishers in London, in Budapest, and in Paris. And I was very encouraged by talks, especially with younger, smarter, well-informed, savvy younger people that are coming up. They're people who are not not in any kind of wishful thinking about the system we live in and where things are going. And there are, I'm very encouraged to say, a lot of younger people who sort of get it. They understand all these things. They put it together in a way that's comprehensive. And that's, to me, very encouraging because, above all, if we're going to have a future, the future has to be, above all, among younger people, and especially people who have the ability, the acumen, to be leaders in the future. I want to mention something else. I would not have gone, probably, on this tour if the cost of it had not been pledged by a supporter of the IHR who lives in Northern Virginia. In fact, that's why I stopped in Northern Virginia on the way back, was to meet with this man. And he has been a supporter of the IHR for some years. He's a rather mysterious guy, and I won't go into details about all of that, but I wanted to just mention that this is not something normally I go on a three-week junket for some reason. But he had heard about this even before I did and urged me to go and pledge to pay the cost of it. A high point of this tour was in England. I was invited to stop in London on the way because by a man named Jez Turner. Jez Turner is I didn't know what he looked like. I didn't know what he was, what kind of person he was. And he runs something called the London Forum. They hold meetings every few weeks or so. They get 50, 60, 70 people at a shot. And they have interesting speakers, and he had heard about what I'm doing, and he said, well, whenever you're in London, we'd be happy to have you as a speaker. And so on the 27th of September, I spoke to a meeting of about 70 people there, quite a good collection of younger people, and I'm struck also at this meeting about the difference between the attitude and the mindset and the basic outlook of younger and older generation. Older people who are sort of my age and older, Their mindset is really much more from the post-World War II period. I cannot emphasize enough how younger people, they see the situation much, much differently. There's no nostalgia for the British Empire, as you'll see with some older Brits. There's no nostalgia for the day that's gone by. There's more of a sense that the era we live in now is one of great problems, and the prospects for the future are not good, and they are much more, I think, realistic about where we're going from here than many older people are. Maybe it's a question just of generation, but I think it's also because I think just objectively the system, that is the liberal democratic capitalist system that prevails in the United States and in Europe, is I think just objectively in a real kind of crisis, and it's shown by the fact that political leaders of the established parties, both in the United States and in Europe, seem clueless about where we're going to go in the future. But in any case, I was impressed by especially these younger people and Jez Turner. Just by the way, Jez Turner had been in the military, in British military for some years, and I was astonished when we saw each other afterwards that he speaks Arabic. He learned Arabic in the British military. And the place where we were staying was right on a road that is now very, very heavily Arab. In fact, there's block after block of cafes where people are smoking hookahs and stores selling things from, in America, when you go to a restaurant and you get Arab food, you'll have usually Lebanese is the most common thing. But here they had Iraqi restaurants, Syrian restaurants, and I didn't know there was much of a distinction, but anyway, that was a big thing. And Jez Turner is able to jabber with these people in Arabic and so forth, but he's a very, very upbeat, outgoing guy, and it's easy to understand why he has the kind of following and support he has from people. Now, at this meeting that I spoke at on the 27th, there were two other speakers, two of them you may know. One was Gregory Johnson, who runs something called Countercurrents Publishing. He spoke. His talk, I think, was over the head of a lot of people. It was about a man named Gian Battista Vico, a 16th century Italian philosopher, and I think it was a little over the head of some of the people. And then Adrian Davis spoke, and some of you remember that he spoke here on August 30th, and at this event, he gave, I think, a pretty brilliant, actually, a very, very well-prepared talk on the origins of the First World War. But it was done in such detail and such erudition that I think also a lot of people were sort of lost about that as well. And there was also a young fellow who gave a very good talk in addition to that. The talk I gave is now on the internet. I haven't seen the talk, but it's very similar to some of the, I made in that talk a lot of the same points I've made at previous meetings here. And it would be no surprise to any of you who've heard me speak on previous occasions. In addition, I also met with people in Paris. I visited the studios of a independent online television station that does a lot of very impressive work in Paris. And I met also with a supporter of the IHR who has a very nice apartment in two blocks from the river in Paris. He's an American who used to work for the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, international agency, and then later went into investment and so forth. Anyway, he was an impressive fellow. It was interesting talking to him about his take on the world. One thing that comes across over and over again, and I'm going to stress this a little bit later in the talk, is the awareness that needs to be increased that the problems that America or France or Germany or England are facing are all basically the same problems. We face the same situation. The entire West is in this kind of crisis. And the more we understand each other, the more we have this kind of cross-fertilization, the more this is obvious is that the entire West is under this kind of threat. Now, I want to say some things about Hungary and about Budapest in particular. I defer to Laszlo, who lived there, because he's much more familiar with it than I am. But I just want to give some of my impressions about it. Again, Hungary is a country of only 10 million people. Budapest, the capital, has more than 1 million people, I think 1,800,000, something like that. But to put it in some perspective, again, Mexico City has more than 8 million people. Again, Hungary is a country of only, the entire country has only 10 million. In Lagos, Nigeria, there are 13 million people. In other words, there are more people in the capital city or the biggest city in Nigeria alone than there is in entire Hungary. So Hungary is not a big country, but it has a very, not only interesting, but I think even an impressive past. Budapest is, well, if you look in any book about different cities, every city in the world is able to show off some buildings that look nice, some things that are impressive. But Budapest is a very beautiful city. I was impressed how street after street, boulevard after boulevard, there are a very, very beautiful buildings. Budapest is also a normal European city. For those who aren't familiar with Europe, one of the features of European cities is that people live and work in the same place. In America, we're used to working in one place and living in another place and commuting back and forth, which means a lot of automobiles. Whereas typically in Europe, even in Paris or London or so forth, people actually live and work in the same place. And one of the results of that is people walk a lot more. Many people do not own automobiles. And one of the results of that is that people look better. They're not as overweight. Americans are notoriously overweight, largely, I think, in measure, because people don't walk as much. And in Europe, you have to walk more. Another thing about Budapest that's very striking, I've been to Vienna a couple of times. It has many similarities with Vienna, and the reason for that is historical. Vienna and Budapest were two capitals of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and so there was a lot of going back and forth between the two. And so much of the architecture, much of the feel of Budapest is very similar to Vienna. Budapest, compared to Western European cities, is much less expensive. The rents are much lower, and the prices of most things are lower. One of the most impressive things about Hungary that is not very well known in America is Hungary produces very, very good wines and a large range of wines, and they're very inexpensive. They're hardly known in America, partly, I think, largely because there's a kind of glut of wine around the world. But bread and wine and many other things in Hungary are less expensive. Now, another thing I wanted to mention, over the years, many people have gotten to know each other through IHR meetings. In fact, there were at least two marriages and children from these marriages that have taken place because of the IHR. There were problems with the marriages, but we don't take responsibility for that. But anyway, one of the things is that a person who, I don't want to give his full name, who used to come to our meetings from Hungary, lives there, and that's who I stayed with when I was in Budapest. And I'm very grateful to him. He had a very nice apartment, close to the center of the city, and easily available to everything. You know, another thing about Budapest is that Budapest expanded enormously. Its period of greatest growth, its most impressive period, was the era, the 40 years just before the First World War. It was in this period that most of these enormously impressive buildings were made. And of course, this happened all over Europe. If you are familiar with anything about the history of Paris, it was in the 19th century that there was this tremendous building of beautiful buildings and houses and so forth in Paris. And the same thing happened in Budapest. Another thing about Budapest, I didn't realize that until I was there either. Budapest has the oldest subway system on continental Europe, even before Paris or Berlin. It's not as old as the London one, but that's why I say on continental Europe. But anyway, I was overall very impressed, more impressed with Budapest than I had thought I would be. Now, I mentioned earlier how to understand something of Hungary's position today, it's important to understand something about Hungary's history. And I'm going to give a very brief overview and highlight certain facts, which I think helps explain some of the situation. Up until 1867, the Austrian Empire was one empire, which is called the Austrian Empire. But in 1867, there was a division of the empire with the Hungarians were in charge of their separate part, although defense, military, and foreign affairs were still united, but Hungary was basically set aside or given its own status as the Kingdom of Hungary and the Empire of Austria. That's why they call it in German the K&K monarchy under the Habsburgs. And in 1867, up until the First World War, it was the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Habsburg Empire, and Hungary was a kingdom within this empire. But within the Kingdom of Hungary included many people who were not ethnically Hungarians, included many Croats, Romanians, Serbs, Slovaks, and others who are not Magyars or ethnic Hungarians. But it was basically a very peaceful period and a very prosperous period, not only for Hungary, but for much of Europe. The First World War, as the great American historian and writer George Kennan says, is the great seminal catastrophe of the 20th century. It destroyed not only the Austro-Hungarian Empire, it ended the Russian Empire, it ended the Ottoman Empire, the Hohenzollern monarchy in Germany. It meant a huge disruption of the continuity of European history. And of course, it was out of the turmoil of the First World War that came the Bolshevik takeover of Russia, the rise of communism, and so forth. But to go back, from 1870 or 1867 up till 1914 was what can be considered a kind of golden age in Hungarian history. It was a period of steady economic and technological development, of vast building, vast construction. And the First World War was this great catastrophe. Now, it was a catastrophe, of course, as I say, not just for Hungary, but for all of Europe and even for Western civilization. It destroyed much of the confidence that the West had before the First World War. In Hungary, in the aftermath of the First World War, as the Austro-Hungarian Empire fell apart, there was a short-lived liberal government for a time, and then, and this is important in history, a small group of fervent Marxists took power in Budapest in 1919 and set up something called, well, in Hungarian or English, the Hungarian Republic of Councils. Now, the Russian word for council is Soviet. So when we talk about the Soviet Union, in Russian it just means the union of councils. It meant that government was not organized by parliaments or by kings, but by what they called councils. And so when they talk about the Soviet Union, they mean it's another term for Soviet. So this, for a short period of time, in 1919, something called the Hungarian Soviet Republic or the Hungarian Council Republic was set up. And this radical Marxist regime was headed by a man named Béla Kun. The second in command was an official named Tibor Samueli, who was People's Commissar for Military Affairs. And a military force called the Red Guard was set up under the command of yet another Marxist fanatic, whose name when he was born was Matyáš Rosenfeld. But like many other Jewish Marxist activists, he took on a less Jewish-sounding name and is better known in history as Matyáš Rákosi. And we'll have a little more to say about him later. Now, this is parallel with the takeover by Marxists, not only in Hungary, but parallel with a similar takeover of Bavaria and, of course, of Russia. In all these cases, fanatic Marxists, committed Marxists, took power in the name of the people, although the people had very little to say about it, and overwhelmingly, the leadership in these movements was Jewish. And nowhere was this more true than in Hungary. Wikipedia has this to say about this particular point, and this is Wikipedia, which is not any kind of extremist thing. If anything, they err on the side of what's favorable to these people. But anyway, it says, in the face of domestic backlash, now this is talking about the end of the Hungarian Soviet Republic in 1919. In the face of domestic backlash and an advancing Romanian force, Béla Kun and most of his comrades fled to Austria, while Budapest was occupied on August 6, 1919. Kuhn and his followers took along numerous art treasures and the gold stocks of the National Bank. All these events, and in particular the final military defeat, led to a deep feeling of dislike among the general population against the Soviet Union and the Jews, since most members of Kuhn's government were Jewish. Now that's what Wikipedia says. Dislike is a polite and kind of sugar-coated way of putting it. This was a horrific thing. It's as if some bizarre group of religious fanatics, as if Scientologists had taken over California and started remaking the whole society in their image. I mean, here's a country that's overwhelmingly Christian. People who are absolutely committed atheists take over, and they say, your religion is going to be swept away. They began taking over private property. I mean, turning the country upside down. And they did the same thing, of course, in Russia, and they did the same thing in Bavaria. Well, the result was, in this experience and also in some other later ones I'm going to go into, this meant a kind of inoculation of the population of Hungary against what Jewish organizations and especially what communists have to say. Now, the end of the Hungarian Soviet Republic was followed then by a very terrible thing called the Trianon Treaty. Now, many of you have heard about, of course, the Treaty of Versailles that was imposed on Germany after the First World War. It's called the Treaty of Versailles because the treaties of peace that were imposed on the countries that lost in the First World War were in various suburb cities outside of Paris. Versailles in the case of Germany, and in the case of Hungary, it was called the Treaty of Trianon because it was signed in Trianon outside of Paris. In both cases, these treaties were not only vindictive and vengeful, they were dictated pieces, treaties. They were in crass and sweeping betrayal of solemn promises that had been made by the British and the French and other Allied leaders during World War I, and above all, in crass contradiction and betrayal of the pledges made by American President Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson pledged that the United States and the Allies were not fighting to defeat anybody, they were fighting merely to end the war, and that they would be happy to make treaties with everybody after they had gotten rid of the bad old governments that would be very magnanimous, and that there would be no changes in the new Europe and the new world that was not in accord with the freely expressed will of the people involved. Supposedly, on the principle, it was called self-determination. This principle was crassly violated, not only in the case of Germany, but also in the case of Hungary. Not only did Hungary lose two-thirds of its territory, it lost territories that were largely and unmistakably ethnically Hungarian or Magyar, and many Hungarians were put under foreign rule against their will, again, in violation of pledges made by Woodrow Wilson, the United States, and by the British and French during World War I. Then what came in Hungary was a period of 24 years, from 1920 to 1944, the Kingdom of Hungary, it was called the Kingdom of Hungary, even though there was no king, under the rule of a man named Miklos Horthy. Miklos Horthy, Miklos is the Hungarian name for Nicholas, by the way, and in Hungarian is an odd language. It's a language in which, well, not only when you go there, the words don't look like anything you've seen anywhere else. I mean, most places the word in Europe, they'll have restaurant. In Hungary, I think it's Etherem. Etherem, yeah. I mean, it doesn't look anything like the word restaurant or anything even close to it. But in another thing in Hungarian, dates are done year, month, day, rather than day, month, year. Or another thing in Hungarian is that last names are given first, like as in Chinese. Whereas everywhere else in Europe, they give the first name first and then the last name. But anyway, the point is, Miklos Horthy was the head of state during this period from the end of the First World War up until October 1944. Horthy is an interesting man. Horthy had been an admiral in the Austro-Hungarian Navy in the First World War. Some of you may wonder, well, what kind of navy did Austria-Hungary have? Well, it had a seaport at Trieste, and it was a large one, and there was a pretty formidable navy, actually, because the Austro-Hungarian Empire was not just as landlocked as Austria and Hungary are today. Horthy was a patriotic man. He was a conservative man. He was very strongly Christian. He was a sincere man. But his temperament, his outlook were very conservative and Christian. He was not a decisive man. He was not a far-sighted man. Maybe he was just what Hungary needed at this period of time. In any case, he was the head of state of Hungary from this period, this very, very bad period at the end of the First World War up until into World War II. Now, Hungary, because it's a Christian country, It passed, even before Hitler came to power, laws that were restricting Jews in Hungary. This is a remarkable thing because this is even before the National Socialists took power in Germany. Hungary was aware of this, again, in large measure because of the very bitter experiences that Hungarians had had in 1919 with the Bela Kun government. In any case, after Hitler did come to power, relations between Hungary and Germany became steadily closer and steadily better. And there's obvious reasons for this. Only Germany, as it became more strong in the 1930s, could help Hungary with its most pressing problem. As many Hungarians saw it, it was to reclaim areas of Hungary that had been taken away by force from Hungary after the First World War. And Germany did help Hungary in that regard. There were two so-called Vienna settlements of 1938 and 1940, and also in 1941 in the during the war, in which large territories, which had been part of Hungary and which were ethnically Hungarian, were restored to Hungary. And this, of course, had the support, overwhelmingly, of the Hungarian people. And Horthy was genuinely more or less a popular leader. But then came the Second World War. Now, Hungary stayed out of the Second World War until June 1941, when Germany, along with Romania and Finland, attacked the Soviet Union. And the, Hungary quickly joined in the battle, joined with Germany and its other allies, and of course they were joined later by other countries, in the huge war against the Soviet Union. Again, it's important to remember how overwhelmingly the great fighting in the Second World War was not involving the United States in Europe, it was involving the Soviet Union. It's the Soviet forces which were far larger, more lethal, and more destructive in defeating Germany and its allies during the Second World War. Again, I'm just quoting from Wikipedia. There's many more books that go into more detail about this. And again, with regard to Hungary and World War II, during the Battle of Stalingrad, by the way, many people do not realize that there were not just Germans in the Battle of Stalingrad or the Soviets, but also Romanians and Hungarians in this battle. But during the Battle of Stalingrad, the Hungarian Second Army suffered terrible losses. Shortly after the fall of Stalingrad in January 1943, the Hungarian Second Army effectively ceased to exist as a functioning military unit. In other words, the Second World War was devastating for Hungary. Again, I'm going to put this in context a little bit later about just how terrible a loss this was, how terrible a blow it was for Hungary, which is not a large country. Now, when many people hear about Hungary in the Second World War, especially in the United States, what they hear of overwhelmingly is what happened to Jews. There's enormous emphasis in the American media on not what happens to Hungarians or Germans or anybody else, but what happens to Jews. And we're all supposed to be conscious of that and mindful of that. Up until 1944, Hungary was a kind of refuge, for Jews in Central Europe. Basically, they lived there. There were some restrictions, but they were very prosperous. Of course, the Jews, as often happens, their standard of living and their wealth was much higher than that of most most Hungarians. In early 1944, Horthy accepted German pleas, and he sanctioned mass deportations of Jews from Hungary. In 1944, from May 15th to July 9th, Hungarian authorities rounded up and deported some 400,000 Jews from Hungary. Most were deported to Auschwitz and the Auschwitz-Birkenau camps. And, as you is well known, most of the deported Jews did not return to Hungary after the end of the war. Now, the United States government and other allied governments protested to Horthy and the Hungarian government, saying, "You shouldn't do this. This is very terrible." And Horthy, in July 1944, ordered a halt to the deportations, and the deportations stopped. One of the remarkable things about the Second World War, we hear a lot about how Germany was interfering and doing all these things. Hungary, or Finland, or Slovakia, or these countries, had far more autonomy than any European state now does within the European Union. States within the European Union have very little freedom to take measures that are going to be out of sync with the other European Union countries, and that's just the way it is now. But anyway, so Horthy ordered the stop to deportations in July 1944, and they stopped. Now, 1944, things are not good. The tide of war is very obviously turning against the Axis countries, and the victory of the Allied powers seemed more and more certain. The Soviet armies had advanced very far into Europe, and by June 1944, the Americans had successfully landed in France, and it was more and more obvious what the tide of war was. And so Horthy secretly then tried to get Hungary out of the war and save whatever he thought could be saved. In August 1944, he appointed a new prime minister to get Hungary out of the conflict. And a few weeks later, Soviet forces actually crossed the border into Hungary. So here it is, September 1944. The Soviet army is actually in on Hungarian soil. And at that point, then, in October 1944, Horthy sought to break the alliance with Germany, and he entered into secret negotiations with the Soviets. On October 15th, 1944, with Red Army troops now in Hungary, Horthy announced on the radio, or an announcement was made on the radio, that his government had signed an armistice with the Soviet Union. Well, the Hungarian army ignored this armistice announcement, and the German, this was of course a violation or a breaking of the alliance that Hungary had made with Germany, and the German governments acted swiftly. They forced Horthy to name as a new prime minister, a new prime minister who would continue to defend Hungary against the Soviets. And under pressure, Horthy named Ferenc Szálasi, who was the leader of the Arrow Cross Party, as prime minister, and then Horthy himself abdicated as head of state. Now, it's important because I'm going to talk a little bit more about why this is important today, the legacy of Szálasi and the Arrow Cross Party. The Arrow Cross Party was a significant political force in Hungary. Its ideology and organization were similar to the National Socialist movement in Germany. At the beginning of World War II, the Horthy government even banned the Arrow Cross Party as a competitor to its own party and forced it to operate underground. When Szálasi and the Arrow Cross Party took power in what remained of Free Hungary in 1944, the main overriding concern was above all to mobilize all resources to defend the nation from the Red onslaught. And this brings me to a little known, but I think very important chapter of history, the Battle of Budapest. Americans know, of course, from movies like The Longest Day or Saving Private Ryan about the D-Day landing. We hear a lot about other aspects of the Second World War from our movies that highlight, naturally, the American role in the Second World War. But very few people understand or know much about just how extensive the battles were that took place in the East. And one of them was the Battle of Budapest. In during the final week of December 1944, the Red Army completed the encirclement of Budapest. And this marked the beginning of the Siege of Budapest or the Battle of Budapest. And in very intense fighting raged in Budapest and around Budapest throughout January 1945 and continued into February of that year. Within the encircled city of Budapest were nearly 33,000 German troops, 37,000 Hungarian soldiers who fought to defend the capital, as well as more than 800,000 civilians. This is in a beleaguered city cut off by and surrounded by the Soviet army. And of course, the Germans and the Hungarians are fighting desperately to try to hold on to this very important city, which is important not only in itself, but also symbolically. Between January 1st and February 16th, 1945, most of what remained of the Hungarian First Army was destroyed in fierce fighting about 200 miles north of Budapest. On January 17th, again, this is in the middle of tremendous fighting, Hitler agreed to withdraw the remaining troops from the Pest eastern side of the Danube River to defend Buda, which is the hilly western side of the city. It's far easier to defend this hilly side of the city than it was the flatter Pest side of the capital. At that point, all five bridges spanning the Danube River were destroyed to hold on to what could be held on to in Budapest. And this allowed the defenders to site artillery and fortifications above the Soviet forces. And this greatly slowed down, at least for a time, the Red advance. The main citadel on the Buda side was defended by SS troops who successfully repelled several Soviet assaults. And in spite of a great lack of supplies, the vastly outnumbered German and Hungarian troops fought furiously, defending the capital street by street, building by building. After 6 weeks of fighting and following a heavy Soviet attack from three directions simultaneously, the main defense citadel on the Buddhist side fell on February 11, 1945. Soviet artillery was then able to dominate the entire city and shell the remaining defenders, who were concentrated in less than 2 square kilometers, suffering from malnutrition and disease. Some 28,000 German and Hungarian troops began to stream northwestwards away from the castle hill, the main citadel. They moved as well as they could in three waves to break out of this encirclement, which each wave, by the way, not only were troops trying to get out, but thousands of Hungarian civilians also fled. Entire families pushing prams trudged through the snow and ice. Now, scenes like this were being replicated all over Central Europe as huge amounts of refugees were fleeing from the advancing Soviets. And although these civilians and many troops used heavy fog to their advantage, again, this is in the middle of winter, this is in snow, many were killed under Soviet artillery and rocket fire. Despite heavy losses, 5,000 to 10,000 civilians managed to reach the wooded hills northwest of Budapest and escape toward Vienna. But only about 600, 700 German soldiers were able to finally reach the main German lines from Budapest. And 2 days after the fall of the citadel, on February 13th, the remaining defenders surrendered Budapest to the Red Army. Now, just by the way, this is also something very little known, is the story of refugees, not German refugees, but refugees from Hungary, Latvia, Lithuania, and other countries who fled westwards along with the retreating German forces because they would rather leave their homes than stay and face the Soviets. I had a professor when I was at Portland State University who, as a boy, was one of these refugees. And he was in a refugee camp organized actually by the SS in, of all cities, Braunau, a little town on the Inn River. And he was in a refugee camp because the Germans were suddenly responsible for huge numbers of these refugees who were fleeing westwards. Now, the casualties and losses in the Battle of Budapest, again, I want to put this in some context. They're estimated at 99,000 to 150,000 Hungarian and German dead, wounded, or captured. 99 to 150,000. Now, this is what Wikipedia says. According to researcher and author Christian Ungvari, some 38,000 civilians were killed during the siege, about 13,000 from military action and 25,000 from starvation, disease, and other causes, and included in the latter figure are 15,000 Jews. Soviet losses in the Battle of Budapest are 80,000 dead and missing and 240,000 wounded and sick. Now, I just want to compare again, make a comparison with the Allied D-Day invasion. The Allied invasion of D-Day, which we've seen movies about, the Allied forces, the casualties for that are estimated at 10,000, of whom 6,600 were Americans. And of that number, the deaths were about 2,500, of whom 1,400 were Americans. Now, that's in D-Day. About 1,400 Americans lost their lives in the American assault on D-Day, but we hear much more about that, of course, than we do about just the Battle of Budapest, the Siege of Budapest. In addition to that, not only was this a very grim time for Hungarians, but it was also a very grim time for many ethnic Germans who lived in this area. And I'm quoting again from Wikipedia. In January 1945, 32,000 ethnic Germans from within Hungary were arrested and transported to the Soviet Union as forced laborers. In some villages, the entire adult population was taken to Soviet labor camps. Many died there as a result of hardship and ill treatment. Overall, more than 500,000 Hungarians were transported to the Soviet Union, including between 100,000 and 170,000 Hungarian ethnic Germans. Again, very little is known about that, of course, in the American media. Again, I'm quoting Wikipedia. When the Soviets finally claimed victory in Hungary, they initiated an orgy of violence, including the wholesale theft of anything they could lay their hands on, random executions, and mass rape. Now again, this is in Hungary, not in Germany. An estimated 50,000 women and girls were raped, although estimates vary from 5,000 to 200,000. Hungarian girls were kidnapped and taken to Red Army quarters, where they were imprisoned, repeatedly raped, and sometimes murdered. In Budapest, now this is another interesting thing, Many Americans have heard the story. It's been made into motion pictures and television specials about Raoul Wallenberg. He was a special Swedish envoy who was stationed in Budapest between July and December 1944. He issued numerous so-called protective passes and sheltered Jews in buildings designated as Swedish territory. Now, the whole story about Wallenberg is not one I want to get into here, but I want to also just mention that here was Raoul Wallenberg. He was a Swedish envoy, and although his measures actually had no legal validity under international law, they were accepted as valid by the German and Hungarian authorities. And what happened to Wallenberg, his fate was that he wasn't shot by the Germans. He was actually, at the end of the war, captured by the Soviets and then died in a Soviet camp. But we're all told he's a great guy, not because of he was put to death or actually died in custody of the Allies, but because he had tried to help Jews. But that is typical of how the emphasis and the focus in American historiography is, that highlights the fate of Jews above that of every other group. Now, to begin, put in context about the Second World War and just how devastating this was. Hungarian losses during World War II, military deaths are usually estimated at something like 300,000 dead. A scholar with the Hungarian Academy of Sciences has provided the following assessment of losses from 1941 to 1945. Hungarian military losses, 300 to 310,000, including 110,000, 120,000 killed in battle. Of course, many others are killed in bombings, or they might die of disease, or so forth. Now, to put this in some context, British military deaths during World War II are estimated at 383,000. That is, it's roughly comparable to the losses of Hungary, but Britain has a population of 47 million, more than four times, almost five times, the population of Hungary. And American dead during the Second World War were 416,000 military deaths, even though the United States was a country more than 10 times larger than Hungary. Again, American losses are about double, maybe almost double of Hungarian losses, but a country of 10 million as compared to a country of 132 million. Now, what happened next in Hungary? At the end of the war, now under Soviet-Russian occupation, the Soviet grip on Hungary steadily tightened. There was a period of transition, relatively benign one, but then a very bluntly Soviet government was imposed, headed by a man whose name we have come across earlier. Mr. Matyos Rosenfeld, or Matyos Rakosi, was head of the government of Hungary under the under Soviet rule from 1947-48 or so up until 1956. during the Rakosi period, and it's a bizarre period in which old symbols of Hungarian history and heritage were done away with and replaced by red stars and so forth. During the Rakosi period, again, I'm just quoting Wikipedia. Again, I'm quoting Wikipedia only because if there's any bias, it's going to be, less pointed than I would probably make. And here's what it says. During the Rakosi period, an estimated 2,000 people were executed and over 100,000 were imprisoned. Some 44,000 ended up in forced labor camps, where many died due to horrible work conditions, poor food, and practically no medical care. Another 15,000 people, mainly former aristocrats, industrialists, military generals, and upper-class people, were deported from the capital and other cities to countryside villages where they were forced to do hard agricultural work. Now, that's what happened up until 1956, basically. Then in 1956, with the death of Stalin in 53, then the famous Khrushchev secret speech, came what is considered by most Hungarians probably the proudest time in 20th century Hungarian history, the Hungarian uprising of 1956. And of course, that's a long story. It's kind of outside the context here, but it is very much remembered and memorialized in Hungary today. After that was put down, then Hungary settled in a kind of a quiet period under a man named Janos Kadar, and Laszlo knows more about that. And as he points out, it was a quiet, predictable, socialist period from 1956-57 to 1989 when finally communism fell apart and was relatively benign in the sense that the Soviets and the communists ceased to try to remake the society and in return people cease to try to overthrow it or rise up against it. Now, I'm mentioning all of this, not just because I think it's important to understand in general, but because there's a controversy that still continues in Hungary today about its history and its role in history. This was pointed up by a couple of things that happened while I was there. I visited something along with a couple of other people, a so-called Museum of Terror in Budapest. This is a big museum. It's maintained by the Hungarian government. And I was there with somebody who knows the director. The whole point of this museum is to portray as bad guys the communists and the Arrow Cross. They're considered the bad guys. Nothing is said, really, in this museum at all about the Horthy period. And that's because there's a great deal of ambivalence in Hungary about Horthy. Horthy is considered he's certainly considered a patriot. He was not a brutal or sinister man. And Jews are very unhappy. Jewish organizations are very unhappy with this portrayal of Hungarian history because the big deportations of Jews did not happen under Szalasi. It happened under Horthy. And they want Horthy portrayed as a bad guy. Well, the problem is most Hungarians don't regard him as really a bad guy, and in fact, there's a kind of rehabilitation of Horthy now taking place in Hungary. Again, whatever you think of Horthy, he was a sincere man, he was an honest man, a conservative man, he was certainly no fanatic or radical. But there's this tremendous thing. In addition to that, there's a monument in Hungary, which I saw, that it was put up about 2 years ago, and it shows a kind of virginal woman representing Hungary and this sort of sinister-looking eagle that's supposed to represent Germany. And it's, again, an effort to portray the Arrow Cross government as the bad government, and communists, of course, but the Horthy regime is sort of left out of all of that. This is very, very misleading, and it's one of the reasons why there is continual demonstrations against all of this. There's not only posters outside of this monument I'm talking about, there are demonstrations going on continually outside this Museum of Terror by people who are very unhappy. Basically, they're leftists or whatever, also Jewish groups. They're very unhappy that the finger is not pointed at the Horthy government. And it's only as a kind of a sop, they say the Szalasi government was bad. Well, the Szalasi government, its big task from the period it was in Hungary was to try to defend the country from the Soviet Union. They had no real time to worry about Jews, really. That was, hostile to Jewish groups and Jews, but that was not its main thing. The biggest blow against the Jewish community of Hungary took place under Horthy. Now, shifting gears, I want to talk again about how some of the talks that I had with people when I was in Europe. Again, I was very impressed by many of these younger people. In London, I had a lengthy conversation with two young Poles, very, very smart young guys who are very active in Polish national circles there. One of them is, he said, the youngest ever member of the Polish parliament. Now, he's not in it now, but he was a few years ago. He's now in his early 30s, but when he was 20s, he was a member of the parliament. And I wanted to understand, well, what's their outlook? What's their worldview? What do they want? They consider themselves Christians and nationalists. They want a kind of Christian nationalist state for Poland. Now, Poland is different than other European countries in a number of ways, but one of them is that it's a country in which Christianity plays a bigger role than it does in probably any other European state. It's part of the identity because the history of Poland is simultaneous with the history of Poland as a Christian country. That is a very important part of the identity. And also, during the long period when Poland was not an independent state, the Polish identity and the Catholic identity were very, very closely tied because the Germans tended to be in that area Protestants, and the Russians, of course, were Russian Orthodox. So the Polish national identity and the Polish religious identity are closely united. Now, that's a strong thing in some ways, but it means that Poland is sort of out of step. It's something similar to the way in which Iranians are both Iranian but also Shia Muslim. Their Shia idea of Islam is also part of the identity with being Iranian. Now, in talking to them, though, it's very, very sad because I believe all of Europe faces a common threat, a common threat of extinction, and that European unity is far more important than whatever divisions there are. You may remember that when Tom Sunak was here, he made this very strong point. And you can see many examples, especially in Eastern Europe, where antipathy, hostility towards other nationalities is more important than the common interests that many Eastern Europeans or Europeans have. It's almost a joke. One person said in Hungary, well, Hungarians debate among themselves who they hate more, Romanians or Slovaks. Now, that's an exact, it's maybe too strong, but the point is there's a strong feeling about this and a feeling. And when talking with these young Poles, I asked them, I said, okay, are you willing to cooperate with other nationalists in Europe if they're not Christian? Now, and the specific example are the Czechs. The Czechs are probably the most non-religious people in Europe. They have the least attendance to church. And, of course, there are Czechs that are worried about immigration, worried about their own identity and so forth. And both of them said, no, we're not going to cooperate with the Czechs. They're not Christian. We're Christian. Okay, well, okay, they're Catholic. Well, because to me, that's very short-sighted, because what Czechs and Poles and Hungarians and Germans and French and so forth also all face is far more important than whatever divisions they had. I asked them also, I said, do you or does your party support continued membership in the European Union? They said, no, we want to leave the European Union. I said, okay, do you want to also leave NATO? And the Poles said, no, we want to stay in NATO. But why? Well, Poles are not afraid of Germany. Germany isn't even a threat. I mean, Germany is so pacifist that they don't even hold on to themselves these days. So Poles don't have any fear that Germany is going to make any claims on Poland. But they are worried about Russia, even though, except for Kaliningrad, there are two countries separating Poland from Russia, Ukraine and Belarus. But they're worried about Russia, and they regard NATO as their protector, as their defender against Russia. And I express the view that, to me, this is very foolish. To me, it's like the Poles relying on guarantees from Britain in 1939. They're not worth very much. I doubt if America would really go to a major war over Poland or Lithuania or Estonia, which it's obliged to do according to the NATO treaty. But more than that, even more important than that, the American government is trying its darndest, trying its utmost, to destroy the very things that these Polish patriots want to preserve, the identity and the heritage of Poland as a Polish and Christian country. And I remind it again, and I've said it over and over, the American government is trying very hard to turn other countries into models of the United States. And as you know, I've quoted the statement made in 1999 by General Wesley Clark, Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, overall command of NATO military forces. And he said, in the modern Europe, there is no room for homogeneous national states. It was an idea from the 1800s, and we are going to carry it, that is, multiculturalism, through, and we are going to create multicultural states. Now, this is part and parcel of America's outlook around the world. It's trying to destroy the cultural, religious, ethnic identity of every other country and make them like the United States. Now, another thing, an observation, too, that was very striking when I was in London and in Budapest. I took some time, actually, it was one occasion I just happened to be there, to visit the American Embassy, both in London and in Budapest. If you've ever seen the American, there was a British series called MI5 that would show scenes of the American Embassy in London. And whenever they did, sort of sinister music would start playing because the American presence is considered a very sort of heavy-handed one. And increasingly, that is the presence of the United States around the world. But the incredible thing to me is just what these embassies are like when you visit them. The U.S. Embassy on Grosvenor Square in London, Mayfair District, in the center of the city, is this enormous structure. But more than just this huge building with an American, huge American eagle on the top of it, it's surrounded by these very, very heavy gates, very, very heavy fences, and these small buildings that you've got to go into first before you even get into the big building. It's not like an embassy in the normal sense of the word. It's like a bastion, a fortress, or an outpost of an empire. the center of a viceroy rather than that of a country that supposedly is just a friend and ally. With on the iron gates surrounding the thing are signs that say no photography. I mean, this is pretty astonishing just symbolically about what the American embassy symbolizes in London, and the American embassy in Budapest is very similar. It's another huge structure, far bigger than any embassy I've seen elsewhere, surrounded by this enormous iron fence with these outposts, and all around it, by the way, guards with big, heavy, formidable-looking guns. By the way, I mean, actually, the hotel where we stayed in London was about a block away from the home of Tony Blair. He's no longer prime minister, but 24 hours a day are men with these hairy submachine guns or machine guns standing outside to protect the man or the people from the people. But anyway, that's just by the by. I mean, increasingly, the United States government plays this kind of role. The American embassy in Berlin is right near the Brandenburg Gate on the Pariserplatz, right near the thing. And it's known now as a center for basically electronic surveillance of all of Germany on the top floor. So much so that even the private phone conversations of the chancellor are now monitored by the American government. Anyway, it's a kind of a shameful thing as an American to see this kind of role. I joked even with a guard outside the U.S. Embassy in Budapest. I said, well, something about how you're defending the American Embassy from who? And well, anyway, whatever. Now, the thing to emphasize, the thing I want to bring strongly emphasize from all of this, again, is that the entire West, all of Europe and the United States face very similar problems. In Hungary, in France, in Britain, and across Europe, there are also similar trends taking place. A very, very widespread sense of distrust of the system. A distrust, a skepticism, an unhappiness that is deep and is growing. The high hopes and expectations from the period immediately following the end of communism in Eastern Europe are gone, as well as the high hopes that came with the expansion of the European Union. As you know, public opinion surveys and startling successes of anti-establishment political parties in recent elections reflect broad and growing unhappiness with the general direction of social, cultural, and economic life. One sign of this, in fact, when I was in France, was the publication when I was there of a new book. In English, the title is The Suicide of France by a Jewish writer named Eric Zemmour. It's at the top of the bestseller list in France. 15,000 copies, they say, are selling every day of this book. And if you look at the IHR website, we've put up items about this book. And he makes the point that for the last 40 years, France has been committing a kind of suicide. It's very similar in outlook, although it's not as detailed, it's more polemical than the book I talked about, Deutschland schafft sich ab, written by Thilo Sarrazin, talking about very similar trends in Europe and in Germany. And again, as I try to emphasize, these trends are happening all over. Europe is committing, with help from the United States and people who have power in the United States, a kind of collective suicide. In any case, it's ruinous. And more people understand this, as evidenced by the increasing votes for these anti-establishment parties and the success of these books that I'm talking about. This book, The Suicide of Europe, even though, in fact, the writer of it can get away with it, he's a Jew from Morocco, he says that large-scale third world immigration is destroying France. And again, the same trends are taking place. Anyone who goes to France or to London or Paris is struck. I mean, I was last in each city, I think, 20 years ago. Even more than in the past, each city is more and more a third world city. Not just people from former colonies, but Chinese and other people are moving into these places. And London, I think, either now or very shortly will be a majority non-British city. One of the most interesting conversations that I had in Europe during this time was a very lengthy one that I was with someone else, we were talking all afternoon and then into the evening, including over dinner, with a correspondent for a leading American daily newspaper. I'm not going to give his name, but this is a very, very influential American daily newspaper. And this writer has been stationed and lived in Afghanistan, and he has lived in Russia. And he's written extensively about both countries. Now, he didn't know who I was, except that he was impressed that I seemed to know something about Hungary and about the world and so forth. And we had very interesting conversations. What's so striking from this conversation is that he and everyone I meet and talk to who's a specialist in whatever area you're talking about, the Middle East, Russia, and so forth, knows that the thrust of American policy is crazy. The idea that you're going to remake societies over in the image of the United States is crazy. Everybody who is a specialist knows these things. They know that American policy is driven either by forces or by ideology out of touch with reality. This is not only wrong, it's harmful. It cannot succeed. It will not succeed. And this was very striking in the conversation with this man whose outlook and whose understanding is very different than the editorial policy of this newspaper. Anyway, but this is not only true in American foreign policy, it's also true in domestic policy. This year marks the 20th anniversary of the appearance of this book. This is one of the most important books to be published since the end of the Second World War, The Bell Curve. Now, this book is not, in any sane society, any kind of radical work. It's a work of eminent common sense, but he backs it up with enormous amounts of facts and information to basically make the point that how successful a society is depends on the intelligence and the ability of the people in that society. And that ability and intelligence is not something that is formed just by environment or socialization, but is in large measure hereditary. This is obvious to people who even take lessons of life. It's obvious from any kind of common sense. But it took this book. Now, the sad thing is, even though this book was, I think, a very substantial book, it was enormously attacked, and it made no difference on American policy. After this book appeared, the U.S. Congress, as I've mentioned in other talks, passed the so-called, by overwhelming majority, passed the so-called No Child Left Behind Act. The No Child Left Behind Act is based on premises about life that are demonstrably untrue. They're false. They're based on the idea that how well a kid does in school is entirely the result of socialization or how he's brought up. This is nonsense. It cannot succeed. It does not succeed. It's one of the reasons why teachers are all opposed to it, because they're held accountable for what their students do. And this is mad, really. But even though, again, the point is that people who know about these things, even people with common sense, understand this. It is not reflected in American policy, either in foreign policy or in our domestic policy. We're still driven in this country, ideologically or for reasons of politics or whatever, to carry out policies that are doomed to failure. Now, I just want to mention this regard. There was an interview with the co-author of this book, Charles Murray, on the 20th anniversary of the appearance of this book. Herrnstein, the other author, is now dead. He died in the meantime. And it's in this month, or October, I guess, now it's November, when this book first appeared. And Murray was asked about how he looks back on the impact of this book 20 years after its appearance. And he said this. He said, "The roof is about to crash in on those who insist on a purely environmental explanation of all sorts of ethnic differences, not just intelligence. Since the decoding of the genome, it has been securely established that race is not a social construct." And he said, "We're not talking about another 20 years before the purely environmental position is discredited, but probably less than a decade." Then he went on to say, "The reaction to the bell curve exposed a profound corruption of the social sciences that has prevailed since the 1960s. The social sciences have been in the grip of a political orthodoxy that has had only the most tenuous connection with empirical reality. And too many social scientists think that threats to the orthodoxy should be suppressed by any means necessary." Now, I put this on our website, and this needs to be emphasized. Again, we're in the form of, it's a kind of corruption of our social sciences, and I would say of our political life, of our educational life, by people who are driven by an ideology that is not rooted in reality, as he puts it. The most tenuous connection, in other words, not rooted in empirical reality. And my point is this. In the system that prevails in Europe and the United States, throughout the West, the system, whether you call it liberal democracy, capitalism, whatever we want to call this system that we have, It's based on an ideology of denial, of falsehood, and of wishful thinking that cannot be saved, and in fact, does not deserve to survive. And in this task, in this situation, our great struggle should be, I think, one of education and enlightenment directed above all to those few who have the heart and the soul and the wit to carry on, directed toward those who can and must be leaders in the new age that will emerge from the wreckage of the one that we live in. And I've been very encouraged in that regard by many younger people, especially, who get this, who understand this. Millions more may not understand at all, but they do understand that we're living in a very, very anxious times and the prospects of the future do not look good. And in all of this, our great struggle in this age of darkness, as I emphasize over and over, is to hold fast and not despair and to persevere in this long struggle before the dawn of a new and better age. Thank you very much.